This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we'll discuss controversial new research on cholesterol-lowering drugs. But first, if you gaze toward the southern skies at night, one of the brightest stars in the sky might catch your eye. It's burning 16 times brighter than our sun, called Formalhut. Great star. It's one of our closest neighbors. It's about 25 light years away. And back in the 1960s, the classic fantasy and science fiction author Ursula K. Le Guin wrote of an imaginary planet called Formalhut 2. But you know how these days science fiction happens to turn into science fact? Well, this week in the journal Science, a group of astronomers reported the discovery, not of Le Guin's Formalhut 2, but a planet they called Formalhut B, a bona fide planet orbiting the bright star Formalhut. They say that the exoplanet is no more than 3 times the size of Jupiter. Now, lots of exoplanets have been discovered before, but what makes this discovery special is that astronomers were able to take a snapshot of the planet with a camera in visible light, an ordinary snapshot. Now, that's never been done before, albeit this was a camera attached to a very big telescope, one aboard the Hubble Space Telescope. Here to talk about it is James Graham, a professor of astronomy at the University of California at Berkeley, a member of the team that took the picture. If you'd like to talk about it with us, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. We're also Twittering. If you'd like to Twitter with us on Science Friday, you write the at sign followed by Cy Fritter. That's SCIFRITTER. And in Second Life, we're also hosting a discussion there. You can join us in Second Life. Welcome to the program, Dr. Graham.
Hello. Thank you, Ira.
How
Pleasure
are you?
To be here.
You must be pretty excited.
Well, this is a tremendously exciting time for astronomers. It certainly is a golden age for astronomy, not just for discovering extrasolar planets, but for understanding cosmology and the universe at large.
Mm-hmm. Explain to us how you found Formalhut B.
So the problem regarding finding these extrasolar planets, or at least taking pictures of them, is that they're tremendously faint. So this particular object turned out to be 3 billion times fainter than Formalhut itself. And so the problem is akin to finding the firefly next to the searchlight. So we require exceptionally good optics, very well-crafted cameras, and then careful analysis of the observations after the pictures have been taken.
Mm-hmm. And we have a picture of it up on our website on sciencefriday.com if our listeners want to look at it. And I'm looking at it now, and two things strike me. One is, where did the star go in the picture? It's not there.
Right. So this picture you may have seen before, as some of my collaborators, Paul Callas and Mark Clampin, published a picture of what's maybe been referred to as the evil eye of Sauron in some of the popular literature. And so these are images taken with an instrument configuration on the Hubble called a coronagraph. And the coronagraph is a fancy name for an occulting spot that's in the camera that blocks out the light from the star. So right at the center, where the pupil is of the eye, is where the star lands. So it's behind the occulting spot.
And because it would be too bright, right? It would sort of blind the telescope.
Precisely. So as you mentioned in the introduction, Formalhut is about 16 times more luminous than the sun. And this planet, we believe, is actually the faintest known object outside the solar system. It has a luminosity of 0.2 of a million, that of our sun.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would imagine, though, that one of the reasons you could see the planet and that dot in the picture is because the star, though, was so bright.
Oh, yes. Some of the light that we see from the planet itself, we believe, is actually reflected light.
Mm-hmm.
And there are various techniques for finding planets. There are planets that are found indirectly using Doppler methods, where you see the wobble imposed on the star by the orbital motion. And you can look for reflected light, which requires a bright star. You can look for self-luminous planets, which is actually a technique used in a second paper that came out in Science this week describing a three-planet system. So this really is a bonanza week for the discovery of extrasolar planets.
Mm-hmm. And so this is really the first picture of a planet like we might take a snapshot of it with our own if we could.
This is certainly, it satisfies those criteria. It's an image in visible light. So you could imagine being a super evolved creature being able to look at Fomalhaut and actually see it with your own eye, which is one of the things that stimulates the imagination here.
It is very exciting, but I'm having trouble. I look at that picture and I see lots of little dots that I would call planets in there.
Oh, yeah.
How do you know which one is a real planet?
So, again, looking at the picture, you see this radial structure just beyond the black dot. Mm-hmm. That's the structure that looks like the iris. And that's a pattern that's associated with optical errors in the Hubble telescope. It's called a speckle pattern. And so what we have to do is measure that pattern very carefully. And we do that by looking at other star systems. For example, other stars of the same type and approximately the same brightness like Vega. And we compare that speckle pattern with the speckle pattern in Fomalhaut. And then the difference allows us to see objects that are associated with Fomalhaut.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a differential comparison of multiple stars.
So do you take time lapse over a period of years, too, to see if the planet's moving?
And if you inspect the image, you'll notice that there are other objects in the field. These objects are very faint, so many of the objects in the field are background galaxies. There are also some background stars within our own Milky Way. And so to be able to distinguish those sources from something that's physically associated with Fomalhaut, we have to actually look for the orbital motion of Fomalhaut's planet around it. So we have to look at multiple epochs. And currently we have two epochs, and we can see the object move. That was essentially for us the clincher when we saw this object physically associated with Fomalhaut.
Why did you choose this star? Did it match a model you thought that you could actually take a picture of?
Oh, so Fomalhaut, from the point of view of planet hunting, became a hot target in the 1980s. In the 1980s, the star was discovered to have a system called a planetary debris disk. That's a cloud of dust orbiting the star, and believed to be the remnants of material left over from building planets. And so ever since then, Fomalhaut has been studied. And in fact, this image that we published 3 years ago, the first version of the evil eye picture, was the first resolution and visible light of that debris disk. And once we saw the structure there, once we saw the hollowed out inner edge of that belt, we were pretty confident that there must be something in there responsible for sculpting the belt. And in fact, one of our colleagues, Alice Quillen in New York, predicted mm-hmm. the location of the planet. Last year, she predicted the location of a planet at a separation of 119 astronomical units. And so that's remarkable insight. And our current calculations, especially by Eugene Chang, have shown that's very consistent with what we see.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to be taking other pictures of it? Can you magnify this anymore? Are you at maximum resolution?
So you can imagine, with two epochs, we're excited. What we're really keen to do is to see a third epoch with the Hubble Space Telescope. So you can bet we will be biting our nails when servicing Mission 4 goes next year and prepares the Hubble to observe again for this target.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible to use any other telescopes besides the Hubble on something like this?
Oh, indeed, yes. So the other technologies that are developing to help us see extrasolar planets from the ground is called adaptive optics, and we'll be using that technology at telescopes like the Gemini Observatory and the Keck Telescope.
Are there other stars that seem like good targets too?
Oh yes, they're very interesting long list of stars with known debris disks. There and the, many of them are brand name stars, mm-hmm. like the bright star in the southern constellation of Pictoris, Beta Pictoris, is another excellent candidate that has a debris disk, mm-hmm. and we will be looking at that system very very closely.
Now, if I wanted to go out tonight and see Fomalhaut, where would I look, and are there any guide points in the sky for it?
So one of the ways that makes it easy to recognize Fomalhaut is that it's a southern star, so you look in the south. You have to look fairly early in the morning these days to see Fomalhaut, but it's a very isolated star. It's the only bright star in the southern sky early in the morning these days.
Wow, so that should be sitting right by itself.
That's correct.
And I would imagine you have spurred other astronomers on now.
Well, there's been tremendous response from the community and a great deal of excitement. And there are various missions being planned by NASA and by ground-based observatories to search for extrasolar planets using imaging techniques. And we're very excited about the momentum that this adds to that effort.
Mm-hmm. Is there any way to see if there's any atmosphere or anything like that on this planet? Or would you know that already?
Our knowledge of the physical conditions on this planet at the moment are exceptionally rudimentary. We can guess what the temperature is. It's probably something like the planet Neptune in our own solar system. So even though this is a luminous star, the planet is remote from the star, so it's rather cool. But it will require a great deal of effort to collect the data to study its atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And that would require things like 30-meter telescopes and the successor to the James Webb telescope. Sorry, the successor to the Hubble telescope, which is the James Webb telescope.
You mentioned in the other paper in Science about the infrared radiation and the other planets.
That's correct, yes.
Can you give us an idea what those planets might be like?
So this is a system with a name that's not quite so euphonious as Fomalhaut. It's called HR 8799. HR stands for the Harvard Revised Catalog. And what has been discovered there is heat radiation left over from the formation of these young objects. And by interpreting the observed luminosity, you can estimate, once you know the age of the system, that these objects are fairly massive. They probably have masses maybe around 10 times the mass of Jupiter.
Wow.
What's remarkable in this system is the fact that there are three objects, and the orbital motion has been discerned in the discovery observations.
All right, Dr. Graham, we'll have to pick that up later, but I want to thank you for taking time to be with us. Fascinating, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
James Graham, Professor of Astronomy at the University of California at Berkeley, talking about the first picture of an exosolar planet. We're going to take a break and come back and talk about a controversial health study about Crestor, so stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Next, an intriguing and controversial health study. This study found that the drug Crestor, which is usually prescribed to lower cholesterol, it could be beneficial even to people who would not normally take it. It is a new drug that hasn't been out that long. To set up the clinical trials, the doctors ruled out volunteers who had signs of serious heart disease or cholesterol levels high enough to merit treatment with Crestor under current guidelines. They selected only study participants who had increased levels of something called high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, or CRP, a marker for inflammation somewhere in the body. And at the end of the trial, the doctors found that the group of patients taking Crestor suffered fewer heart attacks and strokes and ultimately fewer deaths. Should Crestor and other statin drugs like Lipitor or Mevacor be prescribed routinely then to people who show high levels of high-sensitivity CRP to lower their risk from heart attack or stroke? And if so, what about their potentially dangerous side effects? That's what we'll be debating this hour with my next guests. My first guest is an author of the study out this week in the New England Journal of Medicine. Dr. Paul Ridker is professor of medicine at Harvard Med School, director of the Center for Cardiovascular Disease Prevention at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He is one of the authors of the study, which was funded by AstraZeneca, the maker of Crestor. He joins us from the studios of WBUR in Boston. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Ridker.
It's a pleasure to be back here with you, Ira.
You're welcome. My other guest was not involved in the research, but he wrote the accompanying editorial, which urged a bit of caution interpreting the results. Dr. Mark Halatke is a professor. Halatke is a professor of health research and policy and professor of medicine at Stanford in Stanford, California. He joins us from our studios on the campus there. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ira. I'm glad to be here.
You're welcome. Dr. Ridker, let's go over the trial results in a bit more detail. Can you fill it in for us a little bit?
It's pretty straightforward at one level. We as cardiologists believe that we should treat patients with high cholesterol because they're at high risk, and we've learned over the years that you really do want to lower your cholesterol if you're a high-risk patient with high cholesterol. And these statin drugs are very effective at doing so. The problem of the whole field has been that about half of all heart attacks and strokes that occur among, not really patients, but we have to call them healthy individuals in society, about half will occur among people who actually have low levels or average levels of cholesterol. So we set up this trial to only look at people whose levels of bad cholesterol, the LDL cholesterol, were already below not just the threshold for starting these drugs, but below the threshold for treating. So no one in this study has an indication for the statins, but they did have an increased level of hsCRP, this marker of inflammation. We randomized almost 18,000 people in 26 different countries, and the trial was supposed to run for another 2.5 years, but the Data and Safety Monitoring Board recommended that we stop the trial a few months ago because we had a remarkable finding. The rate of new heart attacks was down 54%, the rate of stroke, which can be quite devastating, down 48%, bypass surgeries and angioplasties, very expensive for society, those were down 47%, and perhaps most remarkably, because it really hasn't been seen when we give statins to high cholesterol patients, a 20% reduction in all-cause mortality. So it's really quite striking. There's also issues about how efficient is this approach. And there's something called the NNT, or the number needed to treat. And it's a metric that we use to figure out, well, is this something we can afford as a society, and how's it going to fit in? That number was only 25 over a 5-year period. And what's remarkable to the steering committee is that value is actually less than the value where we currently have for people who have high cholesterol in this setting. So it's really a remarkable finding that I think will change, or at least we have to think about changing the way we practice medicine.
Well, does this say to you that the CRP is more important in screening people for risk of heart attack than their cholesterol level?
Oh, by no means. If your cholesterol level is high and you have some other risk factors, you're a higher risk patient, and we know overwhelmingly that this class of drugs, these statins, are a safe and effective way of lowering that risk, assuming, of course, that we've first dealt with diet and exercise and smoking cessation. This is by no means a replacement or a change of policy at that end. The problem is, what about all the people who have low levels of cholesterol, who we know from the biology of this disease? Remember, we have 20 years of elegant vascular biology telling us that inflammation, the process by which our bodies fight infection, deal with things going wrong, can get reflected by this simple blood test, the hsCRP. 20 or 30 studies around the world have shown if you've got an increased level of this, you're at higher risk. The question has been, what do we do about it? And now we have some evidence that, well, a simple and safe therapy seems to dramatically lower that risk.
What's wrong with that thinking, Dr. Holotky?
Well, let me say a few things. First, I want to congratulate Dr. Ridker on this important study. I mean, the amount of work that goes into doing a study of this magnitude with 18,000 patients and years of work is tremendous. So I think it's a very important study. I think the question always in looking at studies such as this one, which because it's so big and is very difficult to replicate, to do over again. So the question is not so much what happened to the people who were in the trial, but what are the implications for the rest of us who are not necessarily represented in the trial. And I think that there's a couple of things. If I stand back and look at our society as a whole, we know we have an epidemic of obesity now and diabetes, that perhaps the trends in reducing cardiovascular mortality are going to reverse because of these kind of problems. And my own feeling is we need to address the root causes of that epidemic with measures such as better diets and so on before we use as a first step taking a drug. And so I think if you look at the big picture, I think we need to emphasize healthy behaviors and healthy lifestyles. And for some people, quite frankly, it's a little easier to take a drug than it is to change their behavior. So I think that that's the big context for this. The other thing I would say is that Dr. Ridker has, in his results, emphasized this relative risk reduction, which is quite impressive at about 44%. But for your personal decision-making about whether to take the drug, what you really need to see is what would my rate of events be if I didn't take it, and what would the rate of events be if I did, in order to estimate how much benefit you'd get from taking the drug. And it's important to emphasize that everybody in Jupiter had different levels of risk. The underlying levels of risk varied across the different groups of patients who were in that trial. And so for making a decision for an individual person, what you'd like to know is, what is my risk if I didn't take it? What is the risk if I did? If I have high risk, it's more beneficial to me to take this drug because the chance of any adverse events are pretty much the same for everybody. It costs the same to you, about $100 a month, no matter whether you're high benefit or low benefit. So for all of those reasons, I think that we need to be a little cautious. We need to do due diligence on the study. Mm-hmm. I do think it's, again, a landmark study, and I congratulate Dr. Ridker on his accomplishment.
Dr. Ridker, would you suspect that the other statins, your competitors in this one, the Lipitor, Mevacor, other ones, would also show the same results?
So there's a number of issues raised, and they're all very good ones. We'll start with the question you've just asked about other statins. My own research group showed more than 10 years ago that a different statin, pravastatin, also lowered CRP as well as cholesterol, and that the benefit of being on that statin was greater. The relative reduction that Dr. Latke is correctly talking about was greater among those who had this increased CRP. And in fact, my own research group has shown it for all the statins, that they have this interesting phenomena. They're what we call twofer drugs. They both lower cholesterol and they lower this inflammatory process. That being said, the magnitude of benefit we saw here was unexpected. It's almost twice the benefit we see when we give statins to patients with high cholesterol. So that may suggest that the more potent the statin, we know that's a more potent effect for LDL reduction, and it's a more potent effect for CRP reduction. So while, yes, I think it's a class effect in one sense, I think the magnitude of benefit we saw here reflects a very potent drug, Crestor, that we use. I think we kind of hit the sweet spot by selecting people with a high hsCRP and then hitting them with a very powerful drug.
Let me interrupt for a second. The fact that Crestor sponsored this study doesn't influence your data in one way or the other.
Oh, no. This is a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial. There's no way the sponsor can actually deal with it. In fact, it's interesting. Dr. Lack and I both work at very academic medical centers. We held the data here in Boston. The company actually, interestingly enough, never had access to the unblinded data until after the steering committee had written their manuscript and submitted it for publication. It's about as tight a fist as you can hold in this setting.
Mm-hmm. Let me get a question in here coming in on Twitter from Aziz HP says, can the data from the study be reanalyzed separately for each risk group?
The answer is yes, and Dr. Latke raised this appropriately. And I want to agree with Dr. Latke actually on a major issue. He's right. The first step here is going to be lifestyle. We have shown, as have others, that diet, going to the gym, throwing out the cigarettes is a terrific way to lower your vascular risk. That's the most important issue. And it also does lower CRP. So I agree on the lifestyle side. It's just that we've been frustrated. A lot of our patients have a tough time doing that. But the question about different risks, absolutely. So certain groups in the study, like, for example, those with an increased Framingham risk score, this is a scoring system we use. If you had a little hypertension, a little smoking, it's more efficient there and somewhat less efficient if you didn't. But one of the most remarkable findings here was we had about 6,500 individuals who have an increased level of hsCRP and no other major risk factor according to our current guidelines, and that group got approximately a 40% reduction. It says to us that this inflammatory process, which we can't feel, we can't tell we don't do well, is driving an awful lot of this.
And so why then are we still emphasizing, I'll even play devil's advocate here for a second, if this has such a good predictor, why are we still worried about cholesterol levels?
Well, cholesterol remains a very important factor, and they're different.
I mean, people with low cholesterol levels with the high CRP level, and they're at great risk of heart attacks, yet we still keep emphasizing the cholesterol levels.
Well, we have to step back and remember the biology. If you have low cholesterol and a low hsCRP, we have no evidence these drugs are effective. In fact, we did a big pilot study in that group, and we saw very low event rates and no efficacy. So there's a large part of society that should not consider these drugs. Mm-hmm. If you have a high cholesterol and other risk factors, we already know they work. In order to get this process, the heart attack or the stroke, it seems that the cholesterol levels tell us how much plaque is building up in your arteries. The inflammation is telling us the likelihood of that plaque rupturing, and that rupture process is what shuts off the oxygen to your heart or to your brain, causes that heart attack and stroke. So the biology has shifted. We now teach the Harvard medical students about atherosclerosis in a very different way than Dr. Latke and I were taught. We now teach the students it's a disease of cholesterol and it's a disease of inflammation.
Mm-hmm. Any comment, Dr. Latke? You agree with basically that?
I think that there's a couple of things to say. One of them is that I do think that cholesterol is still probably the most important thing that we are dealing with here, partly because it's likely to be involved in the cause. And I do think that the inflammation is involved as well. CRP is a marker for that inflammatory process. It's not as clear to me that it's as related in terms of cause and effect as is the cholesterol. But I do think that we have a better understanding of the overall process. And the other thing I'd say is that, as Paul just mentioned, you know, there are these hygienic measures, the good lifestyle things that we talk about do have an effect on these things too, the CRP and the LDL. And I think that's the foundation for further treatment. And yes, there are some people who should go on a drug because despite their best efforts, they can't get these things under control.
Let me just interrupt and say this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Yes, I'm talking with Dr. Paula Ridker and Dr. Mark Halatke. Go ahead, Dr. Halatke. Did you want to finish a thought there?
Well, I think one of the other questions is that, you know, which patients should be taking this, which ones should go on the drug, which ones should get their CRP tested. And one of the issues in generalizing always is to look at who was in the study and maybe who wasn't as well represented. I mean, if you look at me personally, for instance, I might be a candidate for Jupiter because my
age is
right.
What is Jupiter?
This
it's a
is
planet
the study
in our
Dr. Yes. That was the last segment on the stars. But this is the Jupiter trial.
I see. And
the thing to say is the average age of the patients in the trial was 66. You know, I'm a lot younger than that. You know, the average body mass index in this study was 28. Mine's about 21. You know, it's a lot lower. The average cholesterol was about 108. You know, mine's about 90. So, you know, how well do the results of the study, you know, apply to people like me? I think that Dr. Ridker has just had the opportunity to present the first results, the headlines from his study, and I'm sure that he and his group will drill into these data in a deeper way to give us more details about how things turned out for different groups of patients, and so we can see the actual rates of events. Yes, the relative risks went down in the different groups, but one of the things I'd like to know is, well, how much benefit would it actually give somebody like me?
Yeah.
My risk is much lower than the average person in this study, and so I probably wouldn't get as much benefit from the treatment as right. those people did.
I can actually answer some of that for Mark right now. We've done some of these analyses. It's quite interesting. So while Mark is absolutely correct that the average person in the study was overweight, 25% of this Jupiter trial have a BMI, the body mass index, that's less than 25, a value that we consider pretty reasonable, and that group got the same absolute as well as relative risk reduction, which is interesting. It says it's not about obesity. It's about some other phenomena. We have men over 50 and women over 60. But there's two groups, Ira, that I'd like to emphasize that really have been just excluded from prior clinical trials in general. We enrolled nearly 7,000 women. Women have just not been in prevention trials with statins before. That group got the exact same reduction as did the men. And fascinating to us, their absolute reduction is almost the same, even though we usually anticipate that women are at lower risk. And the other group, one they're very proud of, we randomized almost 5,000 minority patients, Black and Hispanic patients. And in order to do that, it required going to communities across the United States that, frankly, we often don't go to do clinical trials. It required having minority investigators and minority nurses working with us. We went to South Africa and Mexico to accomplish this. And for the first time, we have evidence in minority patients, yes, indeed, statin therapy is highly effective. So there's public health good here at a variety of levels. Mm-hmm. That all being said, Mark is correct. I think we have to always step back, figure out how it applies to the average patient, and get a sense of the big picture. And I would argue I run a Center for Cardiovascular Disease Prevention, and I agree with the first level. Mm-hmm. It's got to be, hey, diet, exercise, and smoking cessation, but we now have what's called an evidence-based paradigm.
All right. Let's
shift in our thinking.
All right, Dr. Rutger, hang on for a second. We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk lots more with Dr. Paul Rutger and Dr. Mark Kalatke about this study. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're talking about the recent CRESTOR study and heart disease with Dr. Paul Rutger, who is at Harvard Medical School, and Dr. Mark Latke, who is at Stanford University in Stanford, California. Let's see if I can get a phone call or two in here before we have to go. Tony in Evanston. Hi, Tony.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. You know, this has been a really interesting week because 2 days ago, somebody had presented the study on the actual study on the statins, and I was hoping this conversation was going to happen. I have so many things to comment on, but one is I'm a physician. I have been doing getting a CRP and a density profile of cholesterol on all my patients as their initial lipid screening, not just a level. And I'm surprised that the density hasn't come up in this conversation, because what I find is that people with high CRPs, unless they're elevated from an acute infection going on or possibly an autoimmune disease, it's almost always associated with a small, dense LDL. And if you look at the research, it's the small, dense LDL that's the problem. It's not that LDL is bad cholesterol. This is what we hear all the time. You know, LDL is your bad cholesterol and HDL is your good cholesterol, and that's really simplifying and not exactly the truth. The truth is that small, dense LDL is problematic, and there's many people who walk around with a normal or low cholesterol level who have small, dense LDL.
So you're saying the CRP is not what we should be looking
at? Well, no, CRP, CRP is inflammation, period. It's inflammation, and we all know that inflammation increases your risk for all kinds of things, including cancer, not just heart disease, diabetes. It's associated with it, but what usually gets your CRP to be elevated outside of an acute infection or an autoimmune disease is that there is small, dense LDL. The same mechanism that causes that small, dense LDL usually causes this elevated CRP. And every doctor should be doing a small, dense LDL
and a
CRP.
Dr. Rutger, any comment on that?
Yeah, I'm afraid I'd have to disagree. While it's anecdotally the case sometimes that these track together, I can tell you in very large studies involving tens of thousands of patients, in fact, the relationship between hsCRP and various forms of LDL, and the caller is talking about small dense LDL, is actually rather weak. It's also important to point out that large studies have been done demonstrating that the best lipid measure remains the total to HDL cholesterol ratio, which is very inexpensive. So, in fact, despite running a complex lipid and prevention center here in Boston, I must say we actually don't use what is called advanced lipid testing on a broad basis at all. We limit it to a very small number of patients.
You were talking about high sensitivity CRP. Is that different than the CRP everybody's talking about?
Yes and no. The clinical test you have to send for the purposes of measuring inflammation and cardiovascular risk or risk of diabetes is the hsCRP test. There is a second test called regular CRP. They measure the same protein but in a very different way, and the regular CRP test simply can't give you the values you need in this very low range that cover the issues we're talking about here today. So in a physician's office or for a patient, it has to be the hsCRP.
Now, you're one of the co-inventors of the CRP diagnostic test, and you currently hold a patent for it, correct?
That's correct.
So do you see how do you see down the road measurements of the C-reactive protein being used?
Well, it's very unclear. I think that my job as a scientist and a clinician investigator is to find out what works, set up experiments that help us to understand, does it pick up risk? 30 investigators worldwide have replicated our data in cohorts all over the world, so we know the hsCRP predicts risk. This trial was set up to find out whether we could do something about it. But I think individuals who write guidelines and sit down have to now consider that evidence.
Let me ask you, if inflammation is the boogeyman here, or a good part of the boogeyman, why not develop a drug that attacks the inflammation directly instead of having the statins do it? Or is that a better class of drug to do it?
Fantastic question, Ira. So this is the future of where medical therapy is going within the vascular biology community. So let me take a second here. The statin drugs, I think, historically will just end up being lucky. They both lower cholesterol and they lower inflammation, and we've been blessed with them because they seem to be so safe. We'll put that aside. You're right. The next step is, can we design drugs that inhibit this vascular inflammation but without also affecting cholesterol or how our blood clots. And in fact, there are many novel drugs in development that have this property. Some of them are being used to treat arthritis. So they already exist, these drugs that we typically have given arthritis patients. And we're trying to put together now something called the Cardiovascular Inflammation Reduction Trial to directly address your question. Can we give a certain kind of drug that inhibits inflammation, but give it on top of a statin, on top of the aspirin, on top of the other things we already do, and then find out, does inhibiting inflammation per se benefit or not? And if it does, we'll have a whole new direction to go to prevent this very deadly disease.
Well, we've run out of time. I want to thank both of you for joining us this hour. Dr. Mark Kalatke is professor of health and research and policy at the professor of medicine at Stanford University in Stanford, California. Paul Ridker is professor of medicine at Harvard Med School, director of the Center for Cardiovascular Disease Prevention at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Gentlemen, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome.
It's a pleasure.
Back in 1913, a handful of California entrepreneurs set up shop across the bay from San Francisco to churn out gallons upon gallons of industrial-strength sodium hypochlorite bleach. They started out selling wagon loads of this stuff to local laundries, breweries, municipal water companies, but pretty soon they developed a lighter concentration household bleach, which they marketed as a cleanser and germicide. It came in small little bottles, pretty similar to the one you might have under your kitchen sink or your bathroom right now. And from the words chlorine and sodium hydroxide, which together form the product's active ingredient, they came up with the company's name, Clorox. Of course, today, Clorox and other chlorine bleaches are a common ingredient in the arsenal of household cleaning products. We use bleach as killing power to sanitize our toilets, to scour the bathroom tile, to cleanse the kitchen. We even use chlorine in our pools to chlorinate our water. But just how does this ubiquitous product work to wipe out bacterial foes? Well, new work in the lab may have found the answer. Joining me now to talk about that research out this week in the journal Cell is Ursula Jacob. He's an associate professor in the Department of Molecular, Cellular, and Developmental Biology at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and she joins us today from a studio in Ann Arbor. Welcome to the program, Dr. Jacob.
Hello, Ira. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's wonderful to be here.
Didn't we always know how bleach worked?
That is a very good question. We all assume, I guess many people assume that we knew. And this is also the response that I now get since we have published this study, actually. Oh, we didn't know how it works. So, and when we started out, we did not start out our research to try to figure out how bleach works. That was not even on our horizon, I have to say. We started out working on a bacterial protein, a stress protein called HSP33. And midway through this project, we actually stumbled onto hypochlorous acid, or the active ingredient in household bleach. And we had to figure out how it works. So that's what we did.
And so how does it work?
So it works very similar than high temperature. So I have to go back a little bit to explain to you what stress does, or what high temperature or bleach does. It has the main or the most sensitive components in our cells, as well as in the cells of bacteria, are the proteins. Mm-hmm. And these are our workhorses, as you, I'm sure you know. They do everything. The muscle proteins allow us to walk, and the enzymes allow us to digest the food that we just here ate in Michigan to get the energy. And the same is true for bacteria. So, and we have thousands of different proteins. And for these proteins to do all those different jobs, they need to have very, very specific, beautiful structures. And we know many structures of those proteins. And you can sometimes compare it to houses. You know, every house has a specific structure to fulfill this specific function. And that's exactly the same with proteins. And what elevated temperatures, for instance, do when we have fever or when we incubate bacteria with elevated temperatures, these structures, these protein structures, some of them are being damaged. We call them the proteins unfold. They lose this beautiful structure.
Because proteins need to fold in the right way for them to work.
And
so when we heat them up or we put bleach on them, they unfold.
Exactly. They unfold. They lose the structure. And what they then do, they lose the function. Now, that's one problem. A much bigger problem, however, is it seems to be, at least during heat shock as well as during bleach stress, is that these proteins not only lose their structure, but they also start to form these large aggregates. So when proteins unfold, they expose their core, which is a very sticky core, but it's usually surrounded by the outside, so it doesn't matter. But mm-hmm. when they unfold, they start to stick to other proteins that also unfold and form these large aggregates. And this is very dangerous for the cells. And you can compare that very nicely when you make your 5-minute breakfast egg. So you start out with the egg and you have this liquidy egg white and yolk and everything is liquid and it doesn't taste very good. And you start heating it up. And within 5 minutes, what you do is you unfold all these egg proteins. They start to clump together. They aggregate, as we call
right.
it, and then they form this hard mass that you can eat with a little bit of salt on top, and it tastes delicious.
Mm.
And so, and this is exactly what we found that bleach does as well. It targets these, we call them thermolabile proteins, proteins that have the tendency to unfold when you slightly rise the temperature. It targets those proteins and starts to unfold them, and then these proteins start to aggregate.
And they're just, so you destroy the proteins in the bacteria and they're gone.
That's at least one mechanism by which we think it works. Mm. Yes.
Does the bacteria have any way of fighting back?
Yeah, and this is actually what we started out with. We started out with a bacterial protein called HSP33 that we found about 10 years ago. And we knew it is protecting bacteria, but we didn't know against what. And this is actually how we found bleach in the first place. Because what you do when you know you have a protein and you don't know exactly what it does in bacteria, you can do something that's in bacteria actually very easy to do. You remove that protein from the bacteria, and then you have a bacteria that makes your protein and a bacterium that doesn't make this protein. So otherwise, they're completely identical. And it's a very nice setup because now you can test under what conditions does your protein become essential for the bacteria to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how we found my postdoc in the lab, Jeanette Winter, the first author of this study, found that out because she treated the bacteria with bleach. And we found when the bacteria lacked HSP33, they were more sensitive to bleach. They also started to have more proteins aggregated, and they died with much lower concentrations of bleach. In wild-type bacteria, on the other hand, which express HSP33, we had fewer protein aggregates, and they withstood a higher concentration of bleach.
Mm-hmm. Talking about the bleach this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, with Ursula Jacob. I guess that's why bleach can hurt you also. I mean, the good cells, if you are exposed to it, or even the chlorine compound of it.
That is true. So what hurts us is mainly when we inhale chlorine gas. That's really what hurts us the most. And this can happen, for instance, and you might know from your mother or grandmother, never mix bleach with ammonia, for instance, because you do the chlorine gas, and that can be fairly toxic when you inhale it. What many people don't realize is that, and I find that always quite fascinating, is that people reinvented bleach because bleach has been invented, or the nature, evolution has come up with bleach about many, many millions of years ago. Because we have in our body these little bleach factories that they're called neutrophils. They're white blood cells. And all that they do is they find bacteria in our body that they want to fight. And they do that by taking these bacteria up and then releasing very high concentrations of bleach to kill off these bacteria.
So our body's making bleach itself to kill the bacteria?
Absolutely.
Wow.
So we actually just reinvented something evolution had come up with long, long time ago.
Now, we talked about inflammation earlier. Could this bleaching be causing inflammation during an attack?
That is something scientists are looking into, because what happens is, especially at sites of chronic inflammation, that you have neutrophils, these white blood cells that make that bleach, and it might be this uncontrolled secretion of bleach not only to the inside where the bacteria are, but to the outside, that starts then damaging the own proteins in the body. Absolutely.
Wow. So we've come full circle on the inflammation question.
I think so too, yes.
and I did not know that we make our own bleach.
Yeah. There's also the idea that we also make bleach in our mucosal membranes, so in our bronchi and in our intestine, to limit bacterial formations. There were bacterial colonization. There was a very nice study in Science a few years ago which showed in fruit flies that there is an enzyme that makes and secretes hypochlorous acid, the active ingredient of bleach, and it limits and reduces the extent of bacterial colonization in the fruit flies. And we have the same protein in our bronchi, in our gut.
Fascinating, Dr.
Yes,
Jacob.
Yeah.
So you're a bleach expert. Thank you very much for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you.
And
it was a pleasure.
Good
Thank
luck
you.
To you. Ursula you. Jacob is an associate professor in the Department of Molecular, Cellular, and Developmental Biology at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Everything you wanted to know about bleach produced inside your body. Now it's time for Flora's Pick of the Week, our video that we have on our website. Flora Lichtman's here. Hi, welcome to back. Good to see you this week.
Hi, thanks.
What's our video pick of the week?
All right, this week I think really it's a fun one. We have these two researchers, and about 10 years ago, they're engineers. They were doing experiments on NASA's low-gravity aircraft, which kind of does these flight parabolas that gives
right.
you like 20 seconds.
Weightlessness.
20 seconds of weightlessness. And they were doing these experiments, and they had some extra time on board. And they thought to themselves, what would happen if we pop a water balloon?
Ooh, pop the water balloon in weightlessness.
In weightlessness.
Wow.
And the results, I think, are pretty visually spectacular, and you can see them on our website.
ScienceFriday.com video pick of the week.
And you may even learn something. So it's not just cool to look at.
It's cool to look. I watched it, and it's amazing. Some of the, you know, the results that you would not expect to happen to weightlessness.
Yes. And I mean, they try a lot of things, hitting it with ping pong paddles, mixing the liquids together. It's like a water balloon fight in space.
In space, but in a safe place, not up there in the shuttle or any place where the water could get around, but it's right there in the Vomit Comet.
Right.
Right where they practice the weightlessness there.
Right.
Up on the plane. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks.
That's up there. At Flora's Science Friday Pick of the Week is up there on sciencefriday.com, and you can watch it and download it, too, if you'd like. Our program is produced by Christopher Intagliata and senior producer Annette Heiss. Charles Breckquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Our intern is Molly Ashford. Josh Rogerson is our technical director and at the controls here, driving here in New York. We also had help today in Second Life from Lynn Cullins, David Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. If you'd like to write us the old classic way, pen and pencil, typewriter, Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Also, we're Twittering. It's SciFritter. That's our Twitter name, SciFritter. Also, we're podcasting and blogging and looking for your videos. If you have some great videos that you'd like to send Flora, we could take a look at them and maybe add them to our video collection. Always looking for new videos. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.